Hey, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, April 12th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Kara Santa Maria. And I want to thank all of you who help make Talk Nerdy possible and who help to ensure that it is 100% free to download. You can do it in a lot of ways. If you go to my website, karasantamaria.com, you can learn about all of them. Of course, you can shop in the Talk Nerdy store. You can rate and review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you download your shows. Or you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy and pledge your support. This week's top supporters include Mary Neva, Michael Gaucher, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, Daniel Lang, David J.E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, June Zapara, Leonard Prince, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Elise Christie, and Robert Christ. Thank you all so much. All right, let's talk about this week's show. I had the incredible opportunity to sit down with April Falcon Doss. She's the executive director of the Georgetown Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy at Georgetown University. Prior to this position, she spent over a decade at the National Security Agency, the NSA, where she was the Associate General Counsel for Intelligence Law. And she also served on Capitol Hill as the Senior Minority Counsel for the Russia Investigation in the United States Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And you may have seen her on television because she's a regular commentator, like on CNN, MSNBC, NPR, talking about data privacy, cybersecurity, and national security issues. So this week, we talk about her new book. It's called Cyber Privacy: Who Has Your Data and Why You Should Care. This is an important one. So without any further ado, here she is, April Falcon Doss. Well, April, thank you so much for joining me today.
Kara, it's such a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. I am excited to talk about your new book, Cyber Privacy: Who Has Your Data and Why You Should Care. And I have to tell you right off the bat, part of the reason that this excites and interests me is because, no lie, only like a few episodes ago, I had Julia Lane on the show to talk about why it's important to democratize our data. You know, and she's somebody who's been working in public service and working in government agencies for decades. And so, you know, we talked a lot about transparency. We talked about data being used for social justice, for representation, for equity. And, you know, but we did also talk about fears around corporate data, fears around government having access to a lot of private information. She talked a lot about de-identification of data and, you know, the ways that government can use data safely. But now we're sort of kind of looking at the darker underbelly of big data, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, these are such current and pressing issues. I mean, we live in such a data-driven world. You know, we all have smartphones, you know, kind of in our hip pocket or, you know, attached at the hip to our smartphones. And we are all generating just unprecedented amounts of data everywhere we go and everything we do. And, you know, the technology is leaping ahead so much faster than ethics and policy and law. And so all of these are huge issues. You know, the topics you talked about with Julia around social justice and disparate impact and de-identification. And yes, absolutely, all of these other issues around the way data gets used by employers, by schools, not to mention social media platforms and apps. And, you know, just sort of this whole data ecosystem we live in that really is challenging our traditional notions of privacy and, you know, what we could and should be able to expect around privacy and security of information about us.
Absolutely. You know, when you start your book, you know, one of the first things that you open up with is sort of a general overview of what is data? You know, how are we data? What kind of data are we actually talking about? What exists out there and who has access to it? And as somebody who worked, you know, not just for the NSA, you know, which is a government agency. Is the NSA? Yes, of course, the NSA is a government agency, but also has done some consulting and been working, you know, with other government agencies and worked, you know, in law. And now, of course, are working in education. You've sort of seen this from a lot of different angles and with, I guess I should say, different security clearances.
Yeah. And, you know, it's such a complex set of issues. There's lots of good reasons for data-driven technologies to exist. There's lots of benefit we get from them, you know, and there are real risks. There's risks to personal autonomy. There's risks in terms of equity and inclusion. There are risks in terms of government surveillance. There's risks in terms of misinformation in the political sphere. There's risks in terms of manipulation of our thought processes and you know, how we approach everything from buying, you know, products online to, you know, just what we're thinking about because it's popped up in our newsfeed on social media. So it's such a complicated area. And yeah, having had a chance to see it from the perspective of national security surveillance, from the perspective of, you know, working with companies of all kinds that are developing technologies, working, as you said, in academia, you know, this is really a multifaceted set of challenges that affects all of us in our everyday lives in ways that aren't always obvious or transparent.
Mm-hmm. And so we're going to definitely dive into those different ways. I think that's so important. One of the things that I think would be important right off the bat is to talk exactly about what we mean when we say data. You know, I let's say, for example, just watched a brilliant documentary that was done by Independent Lens that came out on PBS recently, or wasn't done by Independent Lens, but it was distributed by Independent Lens, called Coded Bias. And it was all about facial recognition and AI and the ways that bias within the algorithm, these algorithms being often written by overwhelmingly white men in the field, now it's, you know, not able to read Black faces very readily, what happens downstream with policing, with, you know, the Justice Department. And so, you know, this is an example of a very overt, a little bit dystopian, or I should say a lot dystopian, but a very overt version of data, my own face. My face is my data. It's, you know, it's how I'm recognized in the world. But there are much less overt versions, right? There are little bits and pieces of data that exist all over the planet that we don't even know we're sort of giving out.
Yeah, that's really true. And, you know, and that's why I thought it was so important in the book to kind of start with that foundational piece of, you know, what kinds of data are we talking about? And so some of the key kinds of data certainly include all the biometric information that you've pointed to. So facial recognition, gait recognition, we can be identified as individuals from the way we walk. Right. I know, it's crazy, isn't it? DNA technology, right? You know, 20 years ago, the Human Genome Project was a moonshot. Nobody knew how hard it would be to sort of map the human genome. Now for $100, we can send our cheek swab away to a commercial DNA testing service for, you know, genealogy and, you know, sort of hobbyist kind of purposes. But that data lives somewhere and can be, you know, tracked and managed. All of our online activities certainly are an important part of this picture. And some of it, you know, we kind of think about, I mean, we know that our location is tracked by our phones and we know that data lives somewhere, but, you know, maybe we're not as mindful of things like cross-app leakage of data, the cross-app and cross-platform sharing of data. So all of our online search history and our online purchase information and our location data. And, you know, I'm glad you pointed to the bias issues because those are really important. You know, one of the things that we've seen is that as these really detailed behavioral profiles are put together about all of us as individuals, you know, that can be used in ways that don't necessarily have an insidious intent, but can have a really unequal and disparate impact. I hope we get to, you know, talk a little bit about that too, because in some cases the challenge is not in the individual pieces of data, but in the ways that they're collated in the ways that they're used to predict our behavior and the ways that that gets monetized, and what that says about incentives to keep us on platforms, it feeds into a whole host of real social challenges, from conspiracy theories to misinformation, and in terms of just the data about us, there's been research showing that essentially with a certain number of clicks, Facebook knows us better than our own family members and partners know us, right? Which is kind of chilling, right? And there's benefits that come from it in some respects. Some people love the convenience of advertising that is specific to their interests. For other people, it's like, oh, wow, that just creeps me out. I don't like the idea of a platform having those kind of insights into me. And right now it's very hard for people, I think, to sort of to get enough clarity on how their data is being used to be sure that they are or aren't comfortable with a particular facet of that use, if that makes sense.
I absolutely think it makes sense. We often talk about, we think about this balance, I guess you could call it, or this push and pull between privacy and security. And it seems like, in some respects, we can look at them as two poles on a continuum, that the more we, Or I should say, privacy and convenience, that the more that we give up about ourselves, the better tailored our worlds, our digital lives become to us, right? And this is an active area of corporate research and of corporate funding. Like you said, this targeted ads or, helping us to make decisions about our shopping experience or whatever. One of the things that comes up for me when I think about that is what a function of privilege it is for us to carry with us our different concerns. And what I mean by that is, recently on the other podcast that I work on, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, we were talking about security and privacy and some of these issues. And I was saying, my big annoyance and my big fear and my big kind of, oh, this is like a dystopian Orwellian future, is all about corporate big data and their ability to, shower me with targeted ads and sort of a future where there's billboards on the moon and where there's like AR pop-ups everywhere I go, and I'm just inundated with like horribly targeted ads. But then I remember pausing and thinking, that's because I don't live in a totalitarian country. That's because, I mean, we got a taste of it during the previous administration, a taste of sort of the slippery slope. But there was a part of me thinking, gosh, if I didn't live in a representative democracy, how scary would my government having my data be? I mean, how scary is it now? Because I'm lucky enough that I'm a white woman living in this country, so I'm not targeted at the airport. I'm not targeted, by biased policing. And I just started to realize all the ways that this could be insidious beyond just annoying.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I'm so glad you mentioned both privacy and security and privacy and convenience, because, at its heart, right, privacy is always something that lives in balance with other equities or interests or rights in society, right? And there's nothing wrong with that, right? And you can talk to any 10 people, in casual conversation, and if you ask them, what do you think is the right balance between privacy and security, all of those 10 people might put that right balance somewhere else on a continuum, right? From, emphasizing privacy to emphasizing security. And same thing with privacy and convenience. And those are absolutely the right, kind of policy arguments to be having, as a society, where do we want to be on these things? But I think that, my motivation in writing the book was that, just getting back to these kind of first principles ideas, that it's really hard in a landscape where the technology changes so quickly for people to even have a good sense of exactly what's at stake in order to kind of have that informed personal opinion about these things. And so, you know, you mentioned privacy and security in the kind of the totalitarian context. And, you know, we can look at China and the social credit system and the really intrusive mechanisms for digital surveillance and see a really stark example of just how dystopian or you know, oppressive things can be. And that goes from, you know, cameras that are, you know, tracking people who are jaywalking and using that to diminish their social credit score, which has impacts for whether or not you can get certain jobs or go to certain schools or get approval to travel, right? To, you know, drone surveillance over protests, to, you know, at the extreme, the corralling of people, of Uyghur Muslims in camps, right? And of course, there's lots of internet censorship there, right? And so we see, you know, and to censor social media platforms in China, of course, you have to be monitoring social media platforms, right? And so, so you're absolutely right. That kind of surveillance, thankfully, is not something that we have in the U.S. It's not something that, you know, any of the Western democracies have. But the reason we don't have them is because we've made a decision that, you know, it's a matter of values, right? That's antithetical in a Western democracy. So what that means is all of us, you know, living in a society where we can, you know, protest against overreach by government and, you know, reach out to our local or state or federal officials and say, we're not comfortable with this. It sort of becomes incumbent on us to say, wait a minute, I think I understand what government agency X is doing, but you know what? I didn't know that my local police department is now using drones over protests as a way of monitoring crowds. I want to understand if my local police department is using facial recognition technology and how and what controls are around that. Who can access that data? What purpose can they use it for? What checks are there on how it gets used? Those things start to become really, really important. And there's so much variation right now in how these issues around data are handled, you know, from one city to another, one state to another, and differences among federal agencies in how well managed and controlled that is.
Yeah, you know, you make so many important points here that I think sometimes when we think about government collection of data and utilization, we go to the China model, we go to North Korea, and we immediately equate that with our own model. So we go, okay, what does the federal government know about me and what do they not know about me? You know, what do they have in some big registry somewhere and what don't they? But you're right, the really kind of insidious or concerning collection, and sometimes collection is not the problem, right? Because it's like, okay, so there's all this data, maybe it's identified, maybe it's de-identified, sitting in a vault somewhere. I remember watching a Frontline episode years ago about post 9/11 data collection and how there was no way to tag it, how there was, you know, it was just a really disorganized, like there was so much data being logged that our servers couldn't handle it. And there's no way to really mine it in a successful or appropriate way. So I think the funny thing is we think about, oh, the federal government has eyes on everything and the federal government is big brother, but really state and local policies are the ones that are probably affecting us on a more meaningful level, right?
In some cases, that is absolutely true. And you know, it's funny, it varies so much. So you know, I had spent a long time in the intelligence community, and because there had been a history of overreach by the intelligence community, basically from World War II into the 70s, there were a series of intelligence community reforms that happened in the mid-1970s that led to a whole structure of, you know, statutes and courts and executive orders, and there are some really well articulated rules for what the federal government through the intelligence community can collect and how they can process data and what they can do with it. Now, not everybody agrees that those rules are set in the right place, but at least there are a really clearly defined set of rules. At the state and local level, when it comes to policing, or when it comes to things that security agencies often think of as intelligence, right? They're trying to be proactive about terrorist threats or some other kind of threat. And that could be domestic terrorism as well as international terrorism, right?
Right. And sadly, sometimes that's miscategorized as things like social unrest.
Exactly. And so without that history of really stringent oversight, it can just vary widely, again, from one jurisdiction to another on a local level. And, the other thing that is really a challenge in the federal area, really federal and state, is, the use of data for not just purposes of analysis, but for purposes of prediction and purposes of making determinations around things like entitlement to benefits and things like that. So, for example, where we see data being used as part of predictive algorithms by parole boards who are trying to predict which inmates are going to be recidivists if they're released on parole, what we find is that actually those algorithms are less accurate at predicting recidivism rates than human parole board members. But there's this mystique about the fact that a computer did it. You know what I mean? And so people kind of buy into, the computer says, right? And so we're seeing predictive algorithms used, again, just in the government context for things like determination of benefits for certain scope of healthcare services where that is Medicare funded. There's, lawsuits ongoing about that right now where people have had their home healthcare reviewed by an algorithm and their benefits cut. So does that make sense? Does it not make sense? So there's a lot being done with these kind of behavioral predictions that really raise a whole host of questions when they're used by government. And of course, when they're used by the private sector as well.
Yeah. And so I think the private sector is an area I really want to get into. Before I do, though, I think I just want to reiterate or kind of continue that conversation about what you just mentioned, which brings up a lot of, I think my most fundamental concerns, which is that, as we know, algorithms and even artificial intelligence, it's developed by people. Yes, we know that neural net technology is really interesting because it's sort of a black box and we're unsure how it reaches its conclusions, but we still know that the programmatic language that starts these sort of runaway algorithms and the data that goes in is developed by humans, and humans are biased. And we know that for the 400-year history of occupation of this land, the stakeholders have been straight white men. We know this. And when we look at the data, when we look at the research, we know that the straight white men who are doing the programming, who are in positions of authority and power to say, this is what I think matters for this equation, what we end up with very often is, as you mentioned, these biased outcomes that oftentimes target disproportionately poor Black and women, poor Black individuals and women, other ethnic minorities as well, LGBTQIA minorities. And it's really unfortunate to see that a system that is meant to increase social justice oftentimes does the opposite.
Yeah, these are such important points. And, there's a couple of great examples of the ways that, the different ways that artificial intelligence, particularly the kind of black box machine learning algorithms that you were mentioning, can have results that, are often unintended by the creator, right?
Oh, sure. This bias is not overt. It's usually not something that we even know we have. It's just that our society kind of cultivates it in us from birth.
Well, so for example, you know, the employment recruiting algorithm that Amazon used is a great example. So Amazon is one of the most advanced companies in the world in terms of predictive algorithms. When you think about, you know, Amazon's recommender algorithms and how early they rolled that out on the Amazon platform. If you liked this, you might also like this, right?
Right. Back when all they sold was books.
Right. So Amazon is, I mean, they are a leader in this space, right? They've been doing this for a while. But when they put together a HR recruiting algorithm to screen job applicants, they very quickly had to discontinue use of it because what they discovered is that the algorithm was continually recommending white male job applicants because it was running against a data set in which the prior job holders skewed towards white male job holders.
And, of course, yeah.
We see so many examples of that. And in a very different kind of example, all of the platforms that connect a provider of services with a user of services have faced real issues relating to the ways in which the platform allows biased activity to be perpetuated. So we saw that in the civil rights audits of Airbnb and Facebook. So for example, on Airbnb, it was discovered that if you were a renter of color, you were less likely to find property owners willing to rent to you. And if you were a property owner of color, you were less likely to be able to command the same prices to rent your property. And of course, if this had been in the context of traditional hotel industry, that kind of bias would be unlawful. And from the Airbnb perspective, they hadn't thought to build in a set of protections that would limit the ability of individuals to live out their own biases through this platform, right? And and to their credit, you know, Airbnb undertook a whole civil rights audit. They've, you know, made a number of changes in the years since they discovered this. But Airbnb is not the only platform that has this problem. So this is just another set of the manifestations of the ways that personal data can be used and misused. And, you know, that's why on the book that, you know, the subtitle was Who Has Your Data and Why You Should Care. You know, so often people say, oh, well, I don't have anything to hide. I'm not worried about it. And you know what? That is A-okay. That is a perfectly legitimate response for people to have. But sometimes when people say that, they're not aware of all the ways that the data about them gets used. And if they were aware that it is not just, oh, some platform or app or company or government agency has access to this information, but here's how they use it. Sometimes people discover that they're really uncomfortable with some of those uses, and they'd really like to either not make use of that service or that product or that app, or they want to, you know, engage with their government representatives and say, I am not okay with this, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, and perfect examples that come to mind is that sometimes when we're talking about these algorithms that are sort of sweeping large segments of data to look for keywords, for example, or to look for specific triggers, there's almost this, like you mentioned, unintended consequence where, let's say I'm somebody who works in anti-terrorism, and that means that my posts and my searches trigger all sorts of terrorism concerns. And I think you see this a lot with individuals who work in social justice movements, who work in community organizing. You know, I've actually seen situations where before a job, I had to submit to background search, and I always elect to get the data. I want to see what they see. So they send me a packet of screen caps, usually of my social media activity, and it's littered with curse words, or it's littered with what the interesting thing is, they'll pull triggers like atheism or like gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and they'll pull these things as if it's hate speech or as if it's, but really, obviously, for me, it's always advocacy, it's allyship, it's open forum discussions about important social issues. And it's just bananas, the terms that are baked into the algorithms that trigger these dings. And so it's like, yeah, you say, I have nothing to hide. Of course not. I'm an upstanding citizen who pays my taxes and who engages in the political process. But I'm also progressive, and I also care about social issues, which means I'm going to end up on some watch list somewhere.
Well, I hope not, because that would be that would absolutely be an abuse of a watch list.
So right. But we saw it happening. You're right. We saw it happening during a lot of uprisings of the women's movement and of the civil rights era, moving into the 60s, 70s, and even 80s. We saw people being kind of surveilled for their outspoken activity.
For sure. And, you know, I think that's why, you know, when it comes to government activity, we absolutely have to continue to make sure that there are guidelines, guardrails, and effective oversight, right?
And we can't do that unless we know, right? Like, that's such an important part of your message. We can't, as the citizens, as the voting public, who our representatives are beholden to because we put them in office, we can't affect this kind of legislative change unless we're aware of what's going on and unless we speak up about it.
Yep. So the transparency is just critically important. And, it's funny because I know we keep intending to get back to the corporate surveillance.
Yes, I know. I was just thinking that in my head too, like second half.
Actually a really good segue, because as many concerns and challenges and questions as there are about different kinds of government uses of data, there is less transparency around private sector use of data and less accountability and less regulation. And, we had sort of a period of, 20 or so years of kind of culturally in the U.S. sort of having this love affair with Silicon Valley, right? You know, they look at all this innovation and these great new things and, you know, all of which is valid, right? There's tremendous innovative energy and tremendous conveniences and things coming out of the tech sector in the U.S. and elsewhere. But because of that sort of love affair, if you will, there was a real hesitancy to demand transparency or accountability from tech platforms in particular. And so we really see that now with the scale, just the sheer scope and breadth of Facebook, of Google, of Amazon, of Apple. Right. And they all have taken somewhat different approaches to privacy. It's no surprise that we now have these really hard conversations around, have these tech giants gotten too powerful? Do they need to be broken up? Is the way in which they keep us a captive audience really corrosive to society? I mean, we saw the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th that was fed by, in part, by social media disinformation. We see the anti-vaxxer, campaigns spreading like wildfire in the midst of a pandemic. And where are they spreading? They're spreading on social media platforms. Why? Because, you know, on a big social media platform with these incredibly detailed profiles of each of us as individuals, it is easy to target in a very specific way messages that are likely to keep our individual eyeballs on screen. That's financially advantageous to those platforms. And, you know, just like the old news adage used to be, if it bleeds, it leads. Now, it's if it enrages, it engages.
Yeah. Oh, you're so right. Yeah.
So what gets fed to us, whether it's you know, from a foreign adversarial government like Russia trying to influence the 2016 presidential election, or whether it's just advertisers or influencers, right? What pops to the top of our feed in all of these platforms is the stuff that is incendiary, because that keeps us on screen. And that is having such a set of corrosive impacts. And it starts with our personal data. It starts with knowing, you know, April is going to be, she's going to go down a rabbit hole. If you pop up this video and this video and this video, April will go down this rabbit hole. Kara will go down this rabbit hole, because this is what April cares about, and this is what Kara cares about, right? This is what April's personality is. This is what Kara's personality is. So it's really, it's so much more than just, oh, I don't have anything to hide. It's, how am I being manipulated for somebody else's purpose, whether that's political or financial or whatever.
It's even more subtle than I think we often give it credit for. Like, we might say on Facebook or on Instagram, well, I'm not actually clicking through to these things. I'm just scrolling. And it's like, they can tell how long your eyes are on a certain part of a page. And that's something that I think we often don't realize. There are things, there are surveillance techniques that are built in that are really sophisticated. And so we might think we're giving information, oh, I have control over what information I'm giving, because I don't click on X, or I'm not actually, you know, finishing the transaction. I'm just, you know, opening the pop-up to learn more. It's like, yeah, they know that. They know that. You know, and it's funny because talking about this sort of transition from government and government power and concern to corporate America, and how much less oversight there is, how much more kind of power in some ways they have. I keep going back. I've just been on a documentary kick lately. I say that about myself, but I watch documentary. This is just my life. It's not a kick. Like, I'm a documentary fanatic. And so I go back to this coded bias. There's a point in this doc where this researcher turned, not turned activist, but researcher and now also activist, named, what's her last name is Bola Mwini. What's her first name? She's so incredible. I highly recommend people look her up. Oh, Joy Bola Mwini. She's a computer scientist at MIT. And she's kind of one of these people who discovered, like, ooh, this algorithm not working in my favor because I'm a Black woman. But when I put a white mask on, it recognizes me, which is crazy. But so she's testifying before, I can't remember if it's Congress or she's testifying before Congress, and everybody's going, this is insane. I can't believe this is happening. We need to put a stop immediately to the government activities that are collecting the data. And she's like, oh, by the way, let me tell you about some patents that Facebook and Amazon own. And that's when they're all like, oh, no. Like, there's this light bulb moment where it's like, oh, what we're doing at the level of the federal government doesn't hold a candle to what's happening within these large multinational corporations, where it's very difficult to put the brakes on this kind of activity. And where, you know, the not only is the utilization right now really sophisticated, but the patents that are held and the research, it's so much farther in front of any sort of regulation we can imagine.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, and there's, again, so many dimensions to it. So, for example, you know, some of what we saw in the 2016 election cycle on Facebook with the Cambridge Analytica scandal was that Facebook had allowed Cambridge Analytica to load an app that people could sign up for that was, depending on what version you saw, either this is your digital life or this is my digital life. You do this fun little personality test. People do these things because they seem fun.
Yeah, and it's like a quiz, like a BuzzFeed quiz. And it's like, meanwhile, let's see what we're taking psychological data on you right now.
Exactly. Yeah. And this particular app also provided data on every user's friends. So, you know, 250,000 people agree to use the app, and Cambridge Analytica ends up with data on 87 million people. And part of what they did with that data was this whole personality analysis along the ocean characteristic of traits, right? Openness, neuroticism, and so forth. So when people like the trolls working in St. Petersburg for the Russian intelligence services, right, were looking to target divisive political messaging to Americans. They could say, aha, I want to target this message to people who have more of an authoritarian streak. I want to target this messaging to people who have more of a progressive or a streak or a libertarian streak or whatever. Because and there's no restrictions against the use of personal data that way, whether it's done by a platform itself or by users of a platform who are trying to build a following, who are trying to attract members to a group, who are trying to, attract paid advertising.
Or who are trying to influence an election.
Exactly.
And we know this, right? We know based on the data that this is real. It happened. There were these groups of people outside of the country, specifically in Russia, but we know that there were outside, influences actively trying to influence the election. And it wasn't one way either, was it? Like, I think we often talk about, this push for Trump, but what really was happening was that there was disinformation flying in all directions with all different types of biases, kind of willy-nilly, just to sow division. That was the important thing, to sow division.
That is 100% correct. And so there were groups that were masquerading as being affiliated with Black Lives Matter, but were really, these Russian trolls, right? There were groups that were that were masquerading as being affiliated with sort of immigration hardliners or gun rights groups in the U.S., but were actually Russian trolls. And we saw it again in the 2020 election cycle, where platforms would routinely make announcements that they had taken down a whole network of inauthentic actors or trolls from, that were believed to be affiliated with the Iranian intelligence services or Russia or North Korea or China. And so actually our personal data, I think, is going to be a huge sort of battlefront, if you will, in the culture wars, in political processes, in democratic discourse. And the thing that many people don't appreciate, we all like to think of ourselves as reasonably intelligent, as critical thinkers, as, all that stuff, right? And what the research shows is that even if a message is completely preposterous, clearly false.
Yeah. Like Hillary Clinton eats babies.
Right. If we hear it repeated, we genuinely start to think it sounds more plausible.
We see this with QAnon.
Exactly.
It's amazing. I'm watching this Colin Hoback documentary about it right now on HBO, and it's bananas how easy it is to hook, line, and sinker a clearly obvious conspiracy that there are people who literally believe in this cabal that eats babies in order to get the blood of the youth to feed their political power. I mean, it's crazy, and yet lots of very normal and non-psychologically ill people believe in this.
Right. And, Facebook's own research, internal research, showed a couple of years ago that, 2/3 of people who joined extremist groups on Facebook went down that path because Facebook's own algorithms was recommending extremist content to them. So, interestingly, when it comes to this kind of thing, there is some movement at the federal government level to really try to take a closer look at what sorts of regulations might be needed. Everything from, again, breaking up the tech companies, because think about it for a minute, right? Suppose that you want to use a search engine that provides you with greater privacy, or you want to have a cell phone device that provides you with greater privacy, or you want to use apps, social media apps that will give you greater privacy protections. There's very little competition, partly because the big companies have sort of gobbled up all the competition as it's come along, right?
Yeah, isn't this not supposed to, don't we have like antitrust? Like, it's so strange that there are these monopolies. Like Facebook and Instagram are the same company.
That's right.
And like, we don't think about, or Google, you know, Google owns so many other companies. So we've got Facebook, we've got Amazon, we've got Google. Between the three of them, I mean, we don't really have any other options.
Well, that's right. I mean, and so traditionally antitrust law in the US, so it's supposed to do two things. It's supposed to foster competition and it's supposed to protect consumers. And traditionally the consumer protection piece of that was looked at in terms of pricing, because the expectation was that if a company owned a monopoly, a railroad company or Standard Oil or any of the big, you know, sort of behemoths of the late 1800s, and early 1900s, if they owned a monopoly, that would drive up prices for consumers. And instead, what we see in this digital economy is, you know the old adage, if you're not paying for the product, you are the product. And so
yes, this is such an important point that I think we need to dig deep into, because I've heard this, you obviously know this. I'm not sure if that's common knowledge, that you actually are the product when you're engaging in a free app like Instagram, for example.
That's right. The way that Facebook is making money off of Instagram is Facebook is using all of my minutes on Instagram to serve up paid advertising from companies who think I might be interested in their products. And there's nothing inherently nefarious about this, right? I mean, again, some people like having the targeted advertising, and for advertisers, social media platforms are a great way to reach consumers.
And this is a model, you know, to interject, this is a model that we sort of understand and we respect at its core. So look at my podcast, for example. I'm able to look at some basic demographic data of my listeners. I know what percentages male, female, and non-binary, or, you know, prefer not to answer. I know, generally speaking, the age range of my users, whether they're listening on an Android or an iPhone, for example. And because of that, when I sell ad space on my podcast, I can say, okay, I'm going to sell this ad that's very science heavy, that, you know, generally targets men, or that, you know, has these sorts of baked in interest, and it's probably going to reach more ears on my show because, you know, this is my audience, for example. Sadly, I'm trying to get more women to listen. Come on, women. Come on with me. You realize that, like, I only really interviewed women lately on the show. Come on, why? But anyway, so, and this is sort of, we know that this was the television, that was its model. It's like, I have to sit through some ads if I want to get this free content. It's a trade-off I'm willing to handle. But the issue was, before, you weren't really learning much about me. You were, you know, it's like a little something here, Nielsen ratings maybe, or like I said, this basic analytics that we have of, like, you know, what's your gender if you're willing to tell me. But I didn't know your personality, and I didn't know the personality of all your friends. That's a totally different level of invasiveness and targeting that, you know, that's where our ears are kind of perking up now.
That's right. You didn't have all of my online purchase history, my online search history. I mean, I think a lot of people don't realize that even if they don't have a Facebook account, Facebook knows a lot about them because there are so many web pages with Facebook third-party plugins. And so it's really hard to escape this level of really detailed behavioral data gathering, whether it's being done by the big platform companies, whether it's being done by data brokers who then sell this data for all kinds of purposes. So back to your question about, where's antitrust in all this? Like, don't we have laws? That's right. There is starting to be a recognition that a negative impact on privacy is something that the law probably needs to be taking into consideration, that consumer protection shouldn't be looking solely at consumer pricing.
Right. And at its core, this is a bipartisan issue. It's interesting because we think of, you know, on the right, there have been big moves to conglomerate corporate power we will often see legislative moves that minimize tort, that minimize, you know, consumer protection, and that maximize, let's say, corporate speech, for example. These have been Republican initiatives in the past, but also these concerns around privacy and personal data and information is a highly Republican platform and talking point. So it's really interesting how those things sort of butt heads a little bit, even within that party.
Yeah, it really is. And it raises so many issues. And so one of the, we could have a whole show just about that.
I know, there's so much to talk about.
But I will say just one interesting little nugget that I'm really looking forward to seeing. This is kind of a wonky point, so just bear with me for a second. But the Federal Trade Commission, which is the chief federal privacy and antitrust watchdog, has launched this big inquiry into platforms. And one of the questions that they have asked the platforms is to provide a response on how much an individual user is worth to that platform measured in dollars. And I am so interested to see what the platforms come back with. I'm sure that the platforms will fight against many of the questions in this inquiry, saying they're overbroad and, you know, can't be easily calculated and, you know, all kinds of things. But one of the challenges that we have with protecting privacy in the private sector context is that we don't have good models for how to value that. What is privacy worth? And that makes it hard for people to sue for privacy injuries because it's very hard to get a court to recognize that there's a cognizable injury if there's no dollar value to it. It's hard to get legislation to address it. It's all these things are hard because we collectively don't really know what we think privacy is worth, you know?
You're right. Well, we don't. But the funny thing is that I can bet you right now, if we went unannounced and opened the books of, you know, the sophisticated books of one of these multinational social media companies, that we would find dollar values connected to individual accounts. I mean, how could they not have an algorithm for that? It's fundamental to their business.
Yeah, there's got to be a whole lot of sophisticated analysis and modeling around how they figure those out.
Absolutely.
For sure.
But whether they share it with it, how hard do we have to work to pry that out of their hands? That's going to be an important question. You're right.
Yeah. But so one other thing that I know we haven't had a chance to talk about that I just want to touch on is, you know, it's not in the private sector context, it's not just the big platforms. That's certainly a whole set of concerns. But one of the other areas that, you know, I touch on in the book is this way in which personal data is used to reinforce power imbalances that already exist in society. So the ways that employers are doing essentially surveillance of their workforce, the way that schools are doing it, and we've really seen this heighten in the context of COVID, where we see, you know, employers wanting to watch their employees working remotely from home through the employees, you know, webcam to make sure they're not goofing off, right?
So scary.
We've seen, you know, we see employers using, you know, ID badges or other kinds of gear in the physical workplace that tracks where the employee is every moment. I mean, you know, how long you spend in the bathroom and whether or not you made a call and whether or not you raised your voice when you were, you know, talking to a customer, right? In the school context, we have, you know, all kinds of issues relating to proctoring of online exams. We have facial recognition technology being used in schools. We have people attempting to use surveillance cameras to predict who might become a school shooter. Again, the predictive stuff is always really fraught with potential bias and error. And of course, we also see all these power imbalances relating to stalkerware, revenge porn, deep fakes, which tend to be used in very gendered ways, right? And so there's lots of ways that we see personal data getting used to kind of reinforce, these power imbalances that can exist either between individuals or between an individual and an entity, like an employer or a school.
Yeah, that's an important point to make, that this is happening not just at the individual level, but at the community level, at the corporate or the kind of employee-employer level, and at the level of government. You know, it's a sort of multi-tiered problem that sometimes is overt, like in the example of revenge porn. There's intent; it's obvious and clear what's happening, and sometimes it's completely under the radar. And it's not intentional at all, but the consequences remain the same.
Yeah. And so even something as simple as the fact that, you know, employers will routinely expect their staff to, you know, have a company-provided phone that they should keep on them at all times so they can be checking email. Well, that's tracking your location, right? Or there's maybe an app that you're required to use for your employment, and it's tracking your location, and that's on your personal phone. And, you know, I mean, there's so many dimensions to this. And again, it's not that any of these things is inherently so nefarious that it should simply not happen at all. It's that in many instances, the technology has leaped ahead so quickly that it's hard for individuals to really kind of have good transparency into exactly what data is being collected about them, how it's being used, what the implications of it are, and whether in a particular instance they either might want to object to that or opt out of that, or, you know, make some different set of choices. And that's really, I think for all of us kind of in our day-to-day lives, one of the big challenges that we have.
Right. And I mean, I think that leads me to kind of the penultimate question here, because we're coming up on the hour, and I always close with the same closing two questions, which I want to get to. But I think the important thing to kind of end on is, so what do we do about this? Because oftentimes I think the fear is that we're being asked to make a decision between our left and our right hand when both of them are tied behind our backs. My employer says, you've got to carry this phone. I can't afford my own phone. Well, that's the phone I'm going to carry. You know, Instagram says, you got to click this box to use the service. Well, I really want to use the service. It's, you know, fundamental to my job, or it's fundamental to my social life or whatever. I'm going to click the box, and I'm going to give away a lot of these things, because opting out sometimes isn't an option, because opting out means giving up the conveniences, or sometimes the fundamental actions in our life that we need because of our position in the social strata.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's sort of two answers to that. One answer is where we have choices and about what we engage in. And the other is where we have choices about what advocacy we might undertake. So where we have choices. So I think it always starts from, you know, just kind of information, right? And having a sense of what's at stake. And again, different people will hear about different things. Some people are really passionate about government, the guarding against government abuse. Some people are really passionate about guarding people in the workplace or in the school and context, right? So all of these different interests are important and valid, and people will care differently about them. So where we have individual choices, right? Where I have a choice, I want to start a small business. Am I going to have a page on Facebook, or am I going to set up a website? And what does that mean around who I can reach and how I can do it? My employer wants me to carry a phone. What range of choice do I have, right? The first thing is where I have choices, understanding what the implications for my privacy and other rights are, and whether I'm comfortable with the choices, the range of choices in front of me. And then second, where I don't realistically have a choice about what device or platform I use or how my data is collected. Then I think it becomes a second kind of choice, which is what kind of advocacy do I want to engage in? Which issues do I care enough about that I want to reach out to local or state or federal representatives, that I want to be part of a public interest group, that I want to get engaged in some kind of nonprofit organization that's doing advocacy? And again, not everybody's going to care about all issues equally, but voices matter. And we've really seen a shift in how the tech sector's responsibilities are starting to be viewed in these areas. And I think we're going to continue to see that with people saying, you know what, I'm okay with these aspects of data use. I am not okay with these. I want to add my voice to a petition or be involved with an organization or reach out to a representative. So, long answer to a short question. I think it all starts with information and, you know, what practical choices can we make and what advocacy choices do we want to make?
I think that's so important. And it's one of those things where I don't want to say we don't have the right to be upset if we're not engaging, because we absolutely do. But unfortunately, nothing's going to be done until our voices in unison shout really loud. It's the way that we are in some ways very lucky. In some ways, it's a little frustrating, but it's the way our country works. You know, our representative officials represent us. And yes, there are interest groups that also represent them, sadly, but ultimately, we have the power to elect and we have the power to boot somebody out of office. And the only way that we're going to see reform and regulation is to make it happen. It's to, you know, speak up and to ensure that we're protected. You know, April, gosh, there's so much more I could talk to you about, but I can't keep you all day. It's unfair to you. I usually close my show by asking my guests the same two questions. And because of their experiences, because of their expertise, what they do for a living, where they come from, I'm always fascinated by the kind of breadth of the answers that I get on these sort of big picture questions. So I was hoping you might join in the fun and give us your insights.
Yeah, you bet.
All right, great. So two things. Number one, when you think about the future, in whatever context is relevant to you, it could have to do with your work and what you've been writing about. It could have to do with something personal, something more governmental, more global, even cosmic. Number one, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night? The thing that you're most concerned about, maybe even a little bit like pessimistic, a little cynical about? You know, what are you kind of not looking forward to? And on the flip side of that, where are you sort of authentically and truly optimistic? What are you looking forward to?
Those are such great questions, and they're so much fun. And I think that, you know, when I look towards the future, the thing that keeps me up at night, quite frankly, is whether or not in 10 or 20 or 30 years, human beings will be able to pass the Turing test, right? Because the ways in which our data and algorithms that run across them can be used to shape our thinking and behavior do create a real risk that we could unintentionally cede a lot of personal autonomy and dignity and just personhood to kind of living in a created environment where the things we think about are the things that we're prompted to think about by an algorithm that says, go think about this, right? And we don't realize it's happening. So certainly I worry about, you know, a surveillance state and all that kind of thing, but I worry even more about the extent to which core issues of personhood and autonomy and self-determination can be undermined by these technologies. On the hopeful side, what I see is that the heart of humanity still lies in creativity. It still lies in those kinds of inspiration and Oh, inspiration is really the best word for it, I think, that seems inherently human in nature. That, you know, whether you think of it as deriving from the soul or from some essence of humanity, however you conceptualize that, that I think is something that even the most sophisticated AI is never going to replace. I certainly hope not. I mean, you know, AI could, I guess, could be the modern version of, you know, monkeys sitting down at a typewriter. You have enough of them for long enough, they write Shakespeare, right? But I think there is still something inherently and intrinsically human and organic that we connect with. And so my hope is that as we continue down this path of all of the blessings and challenges of technology, right, all the great opportunities and risks, that we stay very grounded in what is organic, what is inspired, what is inherently creative. To you know, put it in different words, I guess, you know, the things that we connect with when we're out in nature and off the grid, right? And I think there is a hunger for that. I think actually the climate crisis is causing us to really reckon with just how vital the natural world is. And I hope that that serves as a really effective counterbalance to the allure of the digital world.
Hear, hear. Well, everybody, the book is Cyber Privacy: Who Has Your Data and Why Should You Care? By April Falcon Doss. April, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you, Kara. It has been such a pleasure.
Oh, I've learned so, so much from you. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.